Welcome to the Brookwood and Avalon Life of the Mind podcast. I'm Sherry Walsh, assistant head of Brookwood, here today with Father Jose Medina to talk about the diaries of Eddie Hillesum. Hillesum was in her 20s in the 1940s in the Netherlands during the Nazi occupation. And as she was Jewish, she was subject to the increasing restrictions and then went on to the camp at Westerbork and finally was murdered at Auschwitz. The diaries that Father Jose has been reading and teaching to his upper school History of Contemporary Thought class take Eddie through the different external transitions. But of course, what's really interesting is her internal transition as she matures and as her circumstances change. Do you want to give any background information about Eddie? And hello, by the way.
Hello, Sherry. Just the little that we know of her, that she was 26 when she started writing. So she was born in 1914. She's the sister of a brother that was a musician, a father that was a teacher, a mother that was a Russian immigrant coming out of the Bolshevik Revolution and into the Holland, that at the time in which the Germans were taking over. She comes from a Jewish background, but she's not particularly religious or pious, one would say, not externally religious. Mm-hmm. Very intelligent young woman. She studied the Slavic languages, and it's unclear what else she studied. Some people say that she has a doctorate in law or things like that, but it's very, very unclear of, and especially with the age that she had, 26. It's not that you can study that many things in a few years.
Well, and she's definitely interested in psychology and then working with Julian Speer, right?
Yeah, see, it is in that particular time in which there is a big emphasis in European culture, in trying to understand who the human being is, mm-hmm. after sort of like what has become clear that God is, Nietzsche would say, God is dead, God is no longer relevant to them. So there is a sense of like Freud is from that particular time, trying to understand who is the human being.
Sure, and kind of the popularization of Freud, right? And also after the trauma of World War One.
Which it was quite dramatic for them, for everyone that was alive, as it is dramatic for us, World War II. Mm-hmm. This realization of the evil that human beings can do, the destruction. I mean, World War I is the first time in which you have mass casualties, mm-hmm. whereas before war was a battle between two individuals. Now suddenly you can kill hundreds and thousands of people with gases or things like that. Is the uprise of technology also in the use of this destruction. I'm pretty sure that in many ways, as it is for us this year, we are watching a movie, Oppenheimer, which is precisely about our human capacity to create destruction.
Right.
And what do we do with that?
Right. How does it affect us? To what degree are we implicated? Mm-hmm. What are the consequences to our sense of kind of like who we are and what is the human project.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm interested in a lot of things about these diaries. Maybe the first thing I'm interested in is your desire to teach them. I think you already said that here she is, this very bright young woman who is sensitive and trying to figure out for herself both what kind of person she's going to be as she, you know, mm-hmm. goes through her 20s, but then also sort of how to respond to both externally and internally to everything that's happening around her. I imagine that's the draw,
mm-hmm.
But perhaps you have more to say about that.
I mean, I think I can explain it in multiple, or I can justify it in multiple ways. I can, if I'm sincere or honest with myself, it comes out of the personal experience of having read them and the experience of what it meant to me. Being drawn into reading diaries, a very particular topic of reading, because mm-hmm. you are kind of like entered into the most secret of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you're witnessing something that in theory nobody else has ever witnessed. And that there is a modicum also of respect that comes out of the fact that you get to see what is in the inner life of a person. Mm-hmm. But also the impact that reading those diaries had on me. Like, they drew me in. I like journaling. I think that journaling is very healthy, and especially in our time in which we move so fast.
Right.
But what I noticed in reading the diaries of Eddie was completely different from reading my own diaries. Kind of like, it's a lot easier to actually read the things that I've read before and criticize it, analyze it, have a more external view. They draw you in into an internal, almost like she brings you along something.
Yeah.
The discoveries that she has, the things that she says are profoundly striking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think she's interested in her own creativity. And so some of it is a little bit of sort of exploring that and thinking about also how to, I was going to say optimize, but how to regulate her internal life, how to become more self-disciplined in order that she can be more, that she can be a writer. And so that seems to be a big part of what's happening as she, and that makes her diaries interesting beyond sort of the discussion of the day to day.
Yeah, see, and something that as a teacher, and I think that this is one of the things that was very striking to me, she speaks about creativity as the desire to bring about something new without owning it.
Yeah.
And I think that as a teacher, very much when I teach, I always have this impression that the more you prepare, the less flexible you are with change and with surprises. And but then you lose the beauty of the teaching itself. So if you prepare so much that you no longer enjoy it.
Well, you prepare so much that you're not listening.
Yes.
And I think in that way. So it becomes static, even if it's, you know, brilliant and dynamic in itself. It becomes sort of static, in that it's not, in that the interaction, the dialogic piece of it isn't there.
Yes, I think it's why we human beings, or at least I, like so much, or appreciate so much the explosion of creativity. So like you don't have the problem, you don't own it, it just happens and you enjoy it.
Right.
But when you want to partake of it, you want to be a protagonist of the creation, you realize that the more work you put into it, somehow you get attached in a vicious way. So like you're not free anymore. And it's that aspect of owning things that takes away your freedom.
I think about the poetry class and how sometimes there are students who are very free and interested, and they're doing their stuff, and somebody has a suggestion, or somebody doesn't understand it and says something idiotic, or somebody, like, people respond in all different ways, and the student is super open and thinking about the piece itself. What does it mean that this person thought this? And like, really open and creative. And another student is attached. Mm-hmm. And doesn't want to hear it, only wants the applause. And maybe he doesn't want the applause, but just kind of like, here it is. It's done. It's this thing. And that's the owning, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
get defensive. You want to defend, like, the work that you put into it.
Right.
You want to justify it in a sense, but then you lose the pleasure of why you did what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And she speaks continuously about this.
Yeah, and that's insecurity, right? Feeling like you have to sort of defend it and keep it just like it is.
Yeah.
That's not trusting the process. That's not trusting the truth, like, that you're heading toward.
Or in many ways in Christian settings, we understand this, that poverty will make you free.
Mm-hmm.
But entering into that experience, that poverty is freedom, we can understand that. I understand it very clearly, like, okay, so you let go of everything, and then you have nothing to defend, therefore you are free. But when you through your hands something is created, therefore you have something in your hands.
Right.
You are holding something in your hands. How can you actually be sufficiently detached so that you can still perceive it as a gift? This is a good thing. This is a creation.
Right.
It's beautiful.
And then maybe it's produced through you, mm-hmm. but it's not yours in the way that, again, you want to sort of frame it and hold it and pin it to the wall or whatever.
But anyways, it's the problem of original sin. So it's the that every God gives us the world and we can name it, but it's not our world. Mm. But it's once you name it, you get attached to it.
Right.
And then suddenly it's no longer this gift that mm-hmm. you can play with, that you can yeah. create with, but it's your gift. Mm-hmm. And she beautifully writes about this struggle, which mm-hmm. is profoundly human.
Right. And I guess, too, when it's your gift, it becomes part of your identity. And then if it's taken away, then it hurts you in a way that...
And ergo, what you were saying, if somebody criticizes it, then instead of like being received that, oh, we can make it better together, mm-hmm. it becomes a criticism to my person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she talks about how at... I was just as deeply moved by that mysterious still landscape in the dusk as I might have been before, but somehow I no longer wanted to own it. I went home invigorated, got back to work. The scenery stayed with me in the background as a cloak about my soul. And she talks about wanting to own people and sort of learning to let that go. Later she says, all I felt was wretchedly unhappy and lonely. I realize why now. And all I wanted was to get away from him and to write. I think I know that all the writing was about as well. It was just another way of owning, of drawing things in more tightly to oneself with words and images. And I'm sure that used to be the very essence of my urge to write. I wanted to creep silently away from everyone with all my carefully hoarded treasure, to write it all down, to keep tight hold of it, and to have it all to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is the greatest difficulty that calculus students have. When they solve a math problem,
yeah.
The insecurity comes out of the fact that you've put all of the effort, you studied, you did all of these things, and is it right?
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, you were saying before, trust the process. Like, you put all of the attention that you should have put on,
mm-hmm.
and it is there. It's, mm-hmm. it's come to be something. Now it will be judged, and mm-hmm. you will be corrected by it. But certainly, if somebody corrects us and you've identified your work with yourself,
right.
you are incapable of correction.
Right.
So, surprisingly enough, owning this incapacity to actually separate oneself from the creation that is coming through you
mm-hmm.
Ends up being, make you incapable of learning, mm-hmm. not only of creating, and also of loving in many ways.
Yeah. I think about, Sylvia Plath wrote... she wrote her diaries like 15 years later and a little bit more. But there's a lot of this sort of this desire to, Plath says in her diaries that she cares too much because she might not care at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's an element of that too. You want to care about it, but you don't want to own it. Like, you don't want it to be you. And so thinking about how to navigate yeah. that seems to be part of what she's up to. I actually got a lot of connections to Plath as I was yeah. reading these diaries, and in a very, of course, different way. So you have Eddie learning to kneel. You have Eddie learning to work on her inner life. You have all of this positive spiritual progress that is associated in only a super limited way with Plath. I mean, she goes the other way. But certainly Eddie's ideas about creativity and dissipation, like all of these things that she's kind of thinking through along the way. I don't know. Are there particular issues or ideas beyond owning that stood out to you as you were reading?
I think one thing that is particular of Eddie... And I think that is also important of the time. You were saying that she knows of Julius Peirce, which is a disciple of Carl Jung.
Ah, okay.
Differently from Freud. Freud believed mm-hmm. that God had nothing to do with the human being and that everything could be explained in terms of history, the past. Whereas Carl Jung does not discount the religiosity of the human being.
Right, right.
And Eddie takes seriously the tradition that was given to her and therefore they acknowledges the existence of a God
mm-hmm.
that may communicate through her and transform her life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this...
Your spirituality is really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that is part of what it was more enticing about this diary, because there is a progression. Mm-hmm. There is a clear beginning and end, but there is a before and an after. Mm-hmm. So like she speaks of herself at the beginning as a troubled young woman, uncertain, willing to change. Mm-hmm. And soon enough, she starts talking about a surprising in herself, a transformation.
Yeah.
Something is changing me. Something is happening to mm-hmm. me.
And so a lot of that's about openness, right? I mean, she's paying attention to what's happening in her, and she's able to perceive it. I mean, at one point, kind of late, she talks about how she has the gift of depression mm-hmm. in that, it lets her know. Like, when she does something, when she's off on the wrong path, she gets depressed, and she can tell that she's gone off in the wrong direction in some way, internally, spiritually, mm-hmm. and then she can go kind of trace it back. I think that she's just very, it's Rilken in ways, right? Yes. That sort of openness to what's going on with the self and sort
she's,
of the...
She's strikingly honest. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is very striking is how honest is with herself.
Yeah.
I don't know, we can do as much examination of conscience. Her continuous exploration of herself is very... real, very concrete. Mm-hmm. She's looking at things and not afraid of calling them for what they are.
I think that she went to Spears in the beginning because, or Spear in the beginning, because she was actually suffering from and she seems to learn to kind of channel that. Like, she's using some of those. Some of that ability to look inward for this very different purpose mm-hmm. that takes her kind of out of that into a place where she's very tuned up to again how she wants to discipline herself so that she's prepared for what she's called upon to do.
Yeah, is that precisely this word of open discipline in order to be open. Not discipline in order to be efficient, mm-hmm. which is quite a different. I mean, it's the same amount of work, but the intention is quite different. Mm-hmm. She's not trying to make herself be a great writer. She right. wants to be open so that right. life, mm-hmm. and then she will slowly be given the name, so that the life of God, the Spirit of God, can pass through her. Mm-hmm. And right. I think that intention is quite different. Mm-hmm. So if the intention is to perfect one's own craft, you practice by means of repetition, you find a way. But she's trying to listen. Mm-hmm. She's trying to hone a different skill, that is that of the ear, which for us Christians, I mean, she's trying to obey.
Right, right, yeah. So you're talking about voluntary poverty, and the kind of simplicity, like simplifying the exterior in order to allow for greater freedom. She talks about voluntary asceticism, and then of course there's the external that's placed upon her that's mm-hmm. not. I thought it was really telling, and maybe this is more about me than it does about anything else. But she says that she hopes to accept both the suffering that she chooses and the suffering that she doesn't choose uh-huh. With the same grace and openness and sort of ability to, again, to kind of transmute that suffering into being able to help other people and being able to operate from a place of love. Rather than all of this kind of superficial hate that she sees around her.
Yeah. She identifies that the problem that she has within herself of the difficulty of accepting and loving herself and loving others, the difficulty of dealing with one's own creation, is the same problem as the war. Mm-hmm. So she says if there is a solution to this war that she's suffering, mm-hmm. she's part of it, it has to be identical to the solution to the war inside of myself.
Yeah.
And the best moment in which she reflects about this is when she goes to the Gestapo hall mm-hmm. and she describes, here we are, a bunch of human beings, once our soldiers, once one we could say are the soldiers, the others are the victims. But she says we are all in the same circumstance.
Right.
And what is different is how do we approach this? How do we actually live this particular circumstance that we mm-hmm. all share? And speaks about the meeting a soldier that responds to her very harshly, mm-hmm. insults her, and finds herself, surprises herself, giggling to this man, thinking, poor man, probably he wasn't loved, probably maybe the girlfriend said something to him, and he's suffering inside, and therefore he's vomiting the hurt to all of us. So she's thinking of this personal exploration not as spiritual practice or as an interesting thing to do,
right,
but also with this missionary impetus that if I find the answer to myself, I will have something to offer to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
If I'm able to love myself, see at the beginning is struggling with herself, I should be able to love other people too.
Yeah, yeah.
There is this very deep connection between the within and the without for her.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's like, I can imagine having the insight. I can't imagine living it every day. You know,
yeah.
I mean, like so, and she talks a little bit about that too, that she is that she plans to take her own importance seriously, no matter how ridiculous it looks to other people.
Yeah.
And that she is, that's what she's going to do. And so thinking about, so how she, that's what makes it remarkable that she's able to like follow all the way through with it and to really live that way.
And I think that the beauty of Etty is that she's so honest that you can see the difference between what she thinks she should do and what she surprises herself doing. So
right.
Like in this Gestapo hall moment, she mentions, I surprise myself not reacting with violence to this man or with fear, but reacting differently.
Right.
Something has happened to me. She begins to notice this transformation of grace, this transformation of something else happening to her.
Right. So this moment of integration, this moment of actually experiencing the thing that she sort of in the abstract had put together.
So therefore her interest is not so much in being coherent according to like being good.
Right.
But it's allowing something that is happening in her to take over her.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's as if she gives permission to the God that she prays to affect change in her.
Mm-hmm.
And she discovers, she surprises those moments of change in her life, which gives her hope. Okay, so you're doing something on me, but keep working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And again, I think a little bit about Rilke and that that idea of sort of we are the bees of the invisible, right? And the idea that, and she's very much influenced by Rilke. And she talks about like, you know, what would you read if you knew you were not going to have access to your books anymore? And she's like, the Rilke, I would take the Rilke.
Those pages are beautiful when she's trying to figure out what is it that she can take when she goes to the concentration camp and what is the things that I've memorized. And all of the, through these 2 years of diaries, she's only reading religiously every night, Rilke, the Gospel of Matthew, surprisingly enough.
Huh.
And then Dostoevsky, Brothers Karamazov. Part of it is because she's using it to teach Russian.
Right.
She's teaching Russian on
the
side.
But she's a tutor.
She's a tutor. But for her, those two books in particular, Matthew and Rilke, are become, in a sense, the two authors that actually best express the cry of her soul, the cry of her heart.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, to think about, that's all you really need, right? So I think that's,
surprising. I was talking in history class that we were conversing about St. Francis. For St. Francis, the only book that existed was the Gospel, and that was enough.
Yeah,
he refused to read anything else.
Yeah. So also, I had strong overlap with Flannery O'Connor, right?
Yeah.
So the kind of resignation to misfortune, and what we get in O'Connor is kind of the passive diminishment, the idea of how for O'Connor, as her illness intensifies, she accepts what she has left, and accepts what her remaining tasks are,
mm-hmm.
In that way. So that seemed like a place of overlap. I don't know if there's any other sort of O'Connor cross currents.
Both of them are lovers of the real, lovers of the concrete.
Yeah.
And in many ways, one of the things that Etty will speak from the very beginning is this refuse to be abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this love for the real as a means to
mm-hmm.
connect with God, so like to be able to read within the created, kind of like to be able to see the hand of the creator.
Mm-hmm.
In O'Connor, in C.S. Lewis also is very, very concrete, no? In much of the Christian literature that comes out, especially after World War II, in which the ideologies, the abstraction, in
mm-hmm.
which the labeling of these people are no longer human or
mm-hmm.
becomes kind of like as a reaction to the opposite, is no, it is through the concrete, through the real, through the
mm-hmm.
little experiences that I'm living,
right,
that I begin to appreciate the beauty of the creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Flannery is very much that way.
It's mm-hmm.
like her passion for very small moments that are full of light, in
mm-hmm.
a sense, even the more dark, the more immoral, you could say, the more shocking.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, the idea of the action of grace upon people who are not particularly open to receiving it, and sort of like how that plays out, but also the importance of recognizing the humanity of the very unappealing people around,
yeah.
And sort of how that is, how that's very much a part of what O'Connor does. But back on the passive diminishment, the passage that caused me to leap over was, and yet I felt so deeply peaceful and grateful there in my bed, and meekly resigned to all the disasters and pains that might be in store for me. All disasters stem from us. And then she goes on to talk about the war,
yeah.
And that how for her at that point, it's important for her to think about focusing on her own hate and how to sort of work with that. To recognize the humanity, but also to acknowledge her own sorrow, and then to take kind of a meditative approach to that sorrow. And again, so I don't know, it seems like that's, like there's a lot of kind of mid-century currents that we get,
yeah.
here that are familiar in ways.
In the same way that she's talking about the problem of owning, which is how do I deal with the beauty of creation, she's also thinking about the problem of owning your pain.
Mm-hmm.
She says, like,
yeah.
if you actually sort of like let your pain possess you, then you
yeah.
will be filled with hate, and that will keep growing,
mm-hmm.
and it will destroy you. At the same time, you cannot just ignore the pain. So
right.
how can you embrace? She's thinking about both love and pain, and how to actually relate in many ways to them in
mm-hmm.
a way that is constructive and not destructive.
Right, right, yeah.
So don't make it your hate.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to actually embrace it, carry
mm-hmm.
it almost as part of your cross, but allow, put limits to your pain, in a sense. Don't
mm-hmm.
cling to it, she uses this expression, don't cling to your own pain.
Right, right. I mean, the idea of, she says on the next page, they pass through me like life itself as a broad, is this agony, moments of agony.
Yeah.
They pass through me like life itself as a broad eternal stream. They become part of that stream and life continues. And as a result, all my strength is preserved. It does not become tagged on to futile sorrow or rebelliousness.
So she's perceiving the need for the suffering that I can experience in, she's living moments of great suffering because of the war,
mm-hmm.
To participate, to partake of that suffering, but without allowing that suffering to be the end. Mm-hmm. So like to get stuck on it.
Right.
It's part of life.
Right. And it seems like for a lot of people that happens.
Yeah.
And so the ability to experience it and then to move past it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just because of what day it is, I'm thinking about Macduff. You know, dispute it like a man. I'll dispute it by like a man, but first I must feel it like a man, right? And so the idea of again, like what is a healthy relationship to suffering, adversity, sorrow, violence, and so
it's,
on.
It's the eternal amartya of every single human being, no? If you love too much, then you will burn it.
Yeah.
So like love will become lust, and richness will become greed, and there is no middle ground, there is no moderation there. And in many ways what she testifies to is something else is needed in order for us to be able to live, to truly love and to truly suffer.
So I think, too, about, I mean, since this last weekend, a lot of us were paying attention to Simone Weil. And last time we spoke, actually, on the podcast, we were paying attention to Simone Weil. And I wonder if there are sort of cross currents there for you as well. I don't know.
I think that it would be fascinating to be able to read more about what was the Jewish, the Jihadist tradition in Germany on that particular moment, because it's a very shocking moment. It's like millions of people died, and millions of people that were part of the Jewish tradition. To read these young women who perceive that particular moment or experience that particular moment, to use a word that maybe is not, as a moment of conversion, of change, or, I mean, we are in Lent, of repentance, of something has to turn in me and to turn around me, is quite shocking to see. And Simone Weil and Eti have in common precisely this great desire for an ascetic practice of life. Simone Weil was known for wanting to eat as much as a soldier would,
right,
so that she could experience the same circumstances as other people. This desire to commune with the experience of the other,
right,
and to seek a solution to the great evil that they were witnessing before their very eyes. Both of them are rooted in at least having God as a hypothesis, that God plays a role into this. Whereas for many of the people in their time, God had been set aside. It was not even an option. So therefore the only option was a scientific study or a psychological study. Grace was not a hypothesis that could be contemplated for the transformation of the world. And what I hear in these young women that certainly are familiar with great suffering is a great deal of hope.
How does that manifest? So the desire to commune with the other is an act of hope.
In many ways, yes.
Yeah. And how do you go further with Weil with that?
For Weil, Weil's story is a little bit longer because she perceives, in many ways, in Eti's diary, some of her friends begin to call her kind of like as the embodiment of a Christian. The more she continues to read Rilke and Matthew,
right,
and the more she you can see she begins to use the expressions, she begins to want to embody those words.
Right.
Simone Weil, probably because she lived longer, had a much longer opportunity to continue exploring what that meant. So in many ways, surprisingly enough, Simone Weil was much more in love with Jesus than he was in love with the God of Israel, with Yahweh. He perceives him more relatable. And I would agree with her. Jesus is more relatable. But in her, there is a deeper exploration of what the embodiment of that grace. For Eti, the experience of grace, the experience of a miracle, is there.
Right, right. So for her, it's, I mean, it's more simple, less, I mean, I mean, Simone Weil ends up, I mean, talking concretely, but also abstractly. And you get, I mean, so you have this very simple, straightforward experience in Eddie that that we kind of get to witness in a different way. It's less cooked, right?
Simone she's a philosopher. Right, she's discussing with Simone de Beauvoir. She's got Albert Camus. She's having her days filled with philosophical conversations. Right. Whereas Etty, she wants to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a young woman who's trying to understand herself, and she's writing for nobody but herself.
Right.
Which there is also a great deal of freedom in the journaling,
mm-hmm.
because nobody's watching, and therefore
right.
the temptation of owning it
yeah.
is a lot lesser.
Right, right. That makes sense. And also, when you handed me this book, I think you said something about Joseph Ratzinger. And his attraction to these diaries. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that. There's the foreword to the text that's from Benedict XVI.
I'll tell you the story. I mean, this is, I was telling you, there are many ways in which I can justify why I wanted to read this.
Uh-huh.
This is the more intellectual justification. When Benedict resigned on February 11th of 2013, the day after, was Ash Wednesday, and so he had two public moments, the general audience and then the mass, the mm-hmm. Ash Wednesday mass, and in the general audience started, to the surprise of everybody, talking about Lent,
mm-hmm.
When he had just resigned and we were all a little bit in shock. After a brief reflection about Lent, he said, well, it's really difficult to be a Christian nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But thank God we always have people, God always gives us people to look at,
mm-hmm.
That are always a source of hope,
right.
and suggestive for us to keep doing this work of repentance that he identifies with allowing God to transform us.
Mm-hmm.
And after quoting two people such as St. Paul and St. Augustine in one line,
mm-hmm.
spends then what it is, two pages, talking about Etty Le Soum, Pavel Florensky, and Dorothy Day.
Ah.
And of those three, one is Catholic, Florensky is Orthodox, and Etty is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the three are known to be particularly pious.
Right.
They do have in common, these three people, that they are people who do all of these personal inner work in order to make space for the grace of God to mm-hmm. enter. So I was very struck that someone who just resigned to be a pope and speaks to the world, everybody's listening at that right. point, he mentions three people, two out of which are not Catholic.
Right.
My first approach with Etty was, I read some of the quotes, mm-hmm. and they are very beautiful in isolation. They are really powerful.
I mean, before we started recording, I mentioned that that I started taking notes, but by the end, I was just writing down quotations.
Yeah.
That there are these little moments where she, in this very compact, compelling way, gives us a view of her transformation.
And then, and I had that impression of really, really powerful quotes,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, I could not grab why the Pope on that day would mention her.
Right.
I mean, he's not even Catholic or not a saint or why.
Mm-hmm.
So like a woman of which we only know what she wrote in a journal for a year and a half, and we can assume all of the things that she did, but we don't know much of
right.
her. And it was only in reading the diary that then I realized the power of those writings.
Mm-hmm.
And why he mentioned that in that particular moment, he was talking about we need to repent, that is,
mm-hmm.
to let God transform us. And
right.
the diary is a beautiful testimony to that,
mm-hmm.
of a person.
I mean, there's this recurring image of her in the bathroom, kneeling, right, on the bamboo mat.
Learning to kneel, which
yeah.
is not part of the Jewish tradition.
Right.
And in many ways he speaks about it in terms of like something made me kneel.
Mm-hmm.
And
again, I mean, here she is open to that, Like, I mean, like she's sensitive and understands that there's something in her that needs this, mm-hmm. and then figuring out how to do that. Sorry, I interrupted you.
But to me, like, this summer when I read them again, it made me appreciate a lot more what is the act of kneeling with, mm-hmm. which we would do a great deal of as Catholics. But sometimes it's just a gesture that doesn't, to use a word that she uses, is that doesn't have any wisdom, mm-hmm. doesn't have any meaning, that we do it out of habit. Mm-hmm. And to read of someone that perceives in the act of kneeling as a source for rest, mm-hmm. and a source of energy, mm-hmm. and a sense of self that is greater, mm-hmm. a capacity to embrace who she truly is,
yeah.
in this act that for the most part, so like I've always interpreted as, it truly is affirming that there is someone greater than,
right.
but usually more perceived as a humiliation, mm-hmm. than the true realization of the human.
Right. I mean, she's not doing it because it's the right thing to do, or it's polite in this place to do it, or this is the moment where you do it. She's doing it out of something else that she's compelled to do. Mm-hmm. And again, in the bathroom where it's, I mean, she's by herself, it's private, as she's learning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's pretty interesting.
She's very crazy, yes.
So what, exactly. I mean, like she's open to her own craziness, right? In a way that is ultimately productive and transformative.
She has that radical honesty in many ways similar to Dorothy Day, and in many ways mm-hmm. similar to Flannery O'Connor, in which she doesn't have to justify her craziness. Mm-hmm. She looks at it for what the craziness is, and she's capable of recognizing and judging even there are things that she doesn't particularly like, relationships that she's not particularly happy with. Mm-hmm. And she sees that they are just not okay with her. Mm-hmm. Not okay with her, not okay with a law or okay with a moral code or okay with... There is something in her that is telling this is not the right thing. And at the same time has the patience to allow grace to change her.
Yeah. She is very patient, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
Profoundly patient.
Yeah. And again, too, like she'll have some experience. She'll kind of interrogate the experience. Why did I do that? What was I thinking? And then she'll go for a bike ride and be compelled to sort of stop and have a different experience of what just happened.
Yeah.
And sort of, she's always in a state of sort of processing and again, allowing her own experience to kind of work on her in the best sort of transformative ways.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I think that is something that we modern people have lost, because when you read medieval stories, I always laugh at the fact that what was considered to be a miracle in the Middle Ages. Mm. Remember this one in which a priest was walking down the street, had lost his breviary. Suddenly a shepherd came out of the woods and says, "Did you lose this?" And it's like a miracle, because everything spoke of God, uh-huh. and therefore everything spoke of grace. Everything was mm-hmm. embedded in the sacred.
Yeah.
And we live in a time in which the sacred is not easy to see. We don't mm-hmm. see it.
Yeah.
It's not that it's no longer there. It's that we've lost the capacity to see it. Our eyes are no longer trained, our ears mm-hmm. don't hear.
Right. And it's kind of out of survival in ways, right? That, I mean, that it slows you down to be aware, or it's more dangerous, you're more vulnerable.
And I think that probably the most courageous thing that she does, that or at least that feels courageous to us, is taking half an hour every day to write and mm-hmm. see how did the day go. I mean, we call it examination of conscience, so we have it in our tradition. Mm-hmm. But I mean, to give space to that,
yeah,
in a world that is moving so fast, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, we say we don't have time. It would be interesting to be honest with ourselves and say, is a problem of time, or is a problem that I don't want to?
Right. I don't want to be alone with my own thoughts when I can mediate it somehow, right? I could listen to a podcast.
Because
I could do, yeah.
30 minutes of silence will force you into this radical honesty, mm-hmm. and you might actually discover that you don't like yourself,
right.
as he does.
Yeah, Right, and it gives her the impetus to, that radical honesty gives her the impetus to continue.
Yeah.
And because she's courageous in that way, in the continuing, and she's patient.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else that we haven't talked about that we should talk about? I mean, we talked a little bit about the inner simplicity, inner serenity for the sake of creation, being mature enough to accept your destiny.
Yeah. You know, I gave my class an assignment. I basically asked them to try to identify the place where grace enters in this story.
Mm.
And what did she do?
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, you read through, you can hear how the language is changing. You know? So mm-hmm. at the beginning is more active language and trying to do this and trying to do that, more ascetic, more trying to clean mm-hmm. the room. But then kind of like a passive voice walks in and it's more like things are happening to me and I'm mm-hmm. trying to let this something that is happening to take more mm-hmm. of the space
yeah.
that I have. And there is a moment in which all of this breaks open. It's rare to actually have a text of literature that in which you can identify that the whisper, mm-hmm. we hear the voice of God, the whisper that wakes up Samuel saying,
mm-hmm. right.
saying that the whisper of an angel that comes to Mary and says, so are you ready? This is what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the simple yes of Mary of let it be done according to your word, no, that this dynamic of grace entering into one's life can actually be read through.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the problem of attention of which Simone Weil speaks about and the distraction that we live in, it is fully accessible to us as promised in the gospel. So like if you ask, it shall be given.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the only thing that is separating us from the grace of God is our willingness to give him permission by mm-hmm. indicating, in a sense, as she does, what are the places where mm-hmm. you need help. That a Jewish woman of the age of 26, without any support, without any surrounding mm-hmm. environment, is courageous enough
mm-hmm.
to take to heart what was written in a book that we've read thousands of times. Sometimes it's humiliating to me personally, like, okay, so why are you not doing it? And at the same time, it's profoundly hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
Grace is accessible if you ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that being able to, I mean, certainly it's a challenge in a world in which we can read through and notice that there is something different, notice that there is something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But forgetting or not realizing what is written in words, as a whisper, obviously. So mm-hmm. like it's not that she's able to say, and this day then the light came.
Right, right. and that everything is immediately and completely different. But at the same time, there's a turn.
There is like, she slowly begins to talk differently. She's profoundly visible.
Mm-hmm.
Her boyfriend of all age looks at her and says, so like you are different. You are the same, but you are different. And it is so good to be with you. And your gestures are full of wisdom. You are a woman. You are a real woman now.
Mm-hmm.
That this is the, to me, like this is the most fascinating aspect of Christianity. So like the possibility that this grace is embodied, that this can happen to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand why the Pope actually in reading this would say this is worth knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And hopeful in many ways because she's not particularly a moral character.
Right.
So her choices are pretty questionable, as mm-hmm. as a word that was used in class, questionable.
Yes.
And she is very much so, but there is this, in a sense, radical honesty probably, and openness are the things that characterize her profoundly.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I mean, there is a great deal of courage in being able to look at evil in the face. It's very much,
yeah.
very much involved in a very, very painful time
mm-hmm.
in the European history.
Right, and to keep herself so vulnerable as a person when there's all this that's happening.
Yeah, and it's simple as it's a sentence that it was used also by Martin Luther King then in the civil rights, this sense of that the evil without coincides with the evil within.
Mm-hmm.
But to identify in a moment in which you are persecuted, in which people want to kill you, and to say that the evil that you see that is coming to the violence that is coming mm-hmm. towards you coincides with the violence in yourself.
Right.
That is quite striking.
Yeah.
It's quite striking. There is similarly to the experience of the Jewish people in the Holocaust, the literature and the reflection that comes out of the African-American experience of slavery
mm-hmm.
is equally as hopeful
mm-hmm.
and in many ways are points of interesting points of healing for ourselves and for our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Those who we made suffer, our ancestors or our countries made suffer, seem to hold the key
mm-hmm.
for healing of our own violence is profoundly paradoxical, very Christian, that the one who suffers,
right.
the one who dies in a cross, holds in his hands salvation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No, thank you for coming and talking. Thank you for listening to the Life of the Mind podcast from Brookwood and Avalon Schools. I'm Sherry Walsh here on the Eddie Hillism episode with Father Jose Medina. Our producer is Quentin Walsh. Our theme music is by Fabian Tell. Views expressed are the participant's own.